I have to give my apologies to everyone for having to slip out early. Babysitting obligations don't end because you get older. So, my title's What Should Press Regulation or Media Regulation Regulate? And the operative word in my title is what. And the question that I think you have to answer before saying what should be regulated is rather more difficult question, but as difficult, what can be regulated? And my central contention would be that it is quite possible to regulate speech acts and very difficult to regulate speech content. So if I say that it's quite possible to regulate speech acts, I only have to start listing a few types of speech act that we all know are regulated and in many cases illegal. But let us start out, for example, with threatening, bullying, hate speech, breach of promise. Well, that's not necessarily a speech, just a speech act. Fraud, all sorts of speech acts. The whole of life is littered with speech acts which are forbidden by the criminal law, and there's no, as it were, intrinsic problem with the thought that one can prohibit and then seek to enforce the prohibition of types of act. Now, legislation that refers to content is, of course, much more difficult. One of the reasons I think it's difficult is that people immediately sort of jump and think content regulation bad and don't actually think what it might be or what it takes or why some of our classical arguments for free speech are focused on content and in what ways that limits these arguments. I think it's quite important to think about content regulation, and I don't think I mean that quite in the Ofcom sense of the term, but content is obviously very difficult to regulate because before you can regulate, you have to be able to classify it. And the illustration I used this morning of the, in my opinion, incoherence of data protection legislation, that one and the same content gets classified as private and personal in one context, but is required to be in the public domain in another context, so I think just an illustration of the difficulty of content regulation of any sort. So when we come to the classical arguments for free speech, I think we discover there's quite a lot of focus on content rather than act. Now, these classical arguments, it seems to me, are widely gestured towards and widely not appreciated, and even where they are appreciated, perhaps their limitations are not appreciated. In short, I think it is a move that one really can't make in the present situation to say, oh, well, we know there are rights to free speech. The only response one can give to that is to say, what rights, what shape of rights? And a very illuminating question usually is which are the corresponding obligations and who holds them. So the gesture towards rights of free speech is, I think, what shall I say, the last defence of the scoundrel, and I hope we can abolish that one and start to think about which configurations of free speech we can give arguments for and which we can't give arguments for. And I think that inevitably, in British life, John Stuart Mill is a very important point of reference here. I think he's an important point of reference because he actually uses at least three completely different types of argument for freedom of speech. I'll just mention them in passing. The first one, which of course he takes from much older sources from Milton and which is nowadays often rehearsed using metaphors like the marketplace of ideas is the idea that the justification of freedom of speech has something to do with the discovery of truth. And that is a nice move as far as it goes, but it has an enormous weakness as a basis for an account of media freedom, namely that a great deal of media content, quite appropriately, is not aimed at truth claims. Whether you think that it's opinion pieces or whether you think it's the crosswords, truth claims aren't what it is all about. So we will be absolutely hamstrung if we use one of the up-to-date versions, and there are some, of the classical arguments of free speech as a means to the discovery of truth. It doesn't mean that where the aim is truth, these arguments are irrelevant, but it won't give us what we might want as a generic argument for freedom of speech or freedom of the press. The second argument, also used by Mill, and in a way the one that we are all familiar with as the most famous argument, is that it is a right of self-expression, a right that protects what he calls self-regarding acts. That is, unfortunately, the language has switched. It's self-affecting acts that he means. Acts that affect only oneself. And I'll say something about the supposed harm principle in a moment. Now, that is quite a powerful argument, I think, if appropriately developed, for individual freedom of speech. The thought that the individual and his sense or her sense of self is protected by a right of self-expression is powerful. It doesn't, unfortunately, provide us a very good basis for an argument for media freedoms, because whatever else I think about News Corp, or however you say it, I don't really think that the protection of their sense of self is what is at issue. Mill's second argument is very difficult to extend from the self-expression of individuals to corporate self-expression, including media self-expression. That's one that a transition that is just hard to make unless you believe that shutting your eyes and jumping is a good method of arguing. And I don't think it really is. So I'd be prepared to hang on to a lot of Mill's argument for the speech rights of individuals, but I would think it was not going to give us very good arguments when we're talking about the speech rights of the powerful, and to be remembered that we don't accord most of the powerful a version of speech rights that are modelled on individual rights of self-expression. That's not for corporations, that's not for professional bodies, that's not for educational institutions, that's not for governments. So self-expression is, again, not a very promising basis for a powerful argument for media freedoms. This, I think, has got confused because of the similarity in language to the convention rights. The European Convention on Human Rights proclaims, of course, in the first place, an individual right of what is called freedom of expression. Note, not freedom of self-expression, freedom of expression. And that has become a sort of generic term for press freedom, but it doesn't, as it were, get any lift off from the million arguments of old. So what do I think could provide us with our best argument? I suspect it is the argument from the importance to social, cultural, civic, and above all, democratic life of a free press. And that seems to me a good landing point. Of course, there have been notable people, I think of Michael John writing in the US, who've taken this line of argument. I fear it's often muddied with lots of other lines of argument. But let's take it that that would be a good line of argument. it's not obvious, just looking at the surface of it, what configuration of media freedoms are then justified, because the answer you can give is a sort of generic one. That configuration of media freedoms, which in a given society, in a given epoch, actually most effectively supports not merely the rights of individuals, but also cultural, civic, social and political life. And that's pretty indeterminate. And actually that is probably not so far away from a way one might read the convention rights, because if you read Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights, you discover that a great number of different sorts of restrictions on media freedom are seen as possible or necessary. So I think the first step is to give up the thought that we know what speech rights are protected by freedom of speech or what media rights are protected by freedom of the press. How to move forward then from these classical arguments? I think that one of the things I want to keep on the table is there really is a difference between the powerless and the powerful in this, and we have to respect that. But the other one, which it seems to me any discussion of media ethics might take seriously, is that the activity that we are looking at, the speech acts we are looking at, are intended to communicate. They are not mere self-expression. I think in that phrase, self-expression, we can see the origins of thought about free speech. For example, their close connection between freedom of worship and things like that, where the individual's freedom to speak is terribly important. When we're talking about the media, whatever else we are talking about, we're surely talking about attempted communication. Now, that immediately narrows things very much, because as soon as we're talking about communication, we have audiences, intended audiences, and of course wider potential audiences. So a proper question when you're talking about press freedom, media freedom, is not merely what do the press have a right to do, but what are their duties to readers, listeners, and viewers? And I think that is just the fundamental move one has to make. And I would say that before we get into any regulation in the sense in which it is now typically discussed, we have to look at the, I'm going to use a Kantian phrase, most of you know I'm a rather card-carrying Kantian, look at what I would call the necessary conditions of the possibility of communicating. Well, what are they? I think the first is you don't communicate unless you try to make your communication accessible to your intended audience. I think the media get a big tick on this. They do try to. They sell it cheaply, they provide it and the rest of it. Second standard that I think we might all think pretty important is you don't communicate unless you try to make the content of your speech act intelligible to your intended audience. Intelligibility is a non-trivial demand, and we have all of us read reporting and comment that is actually, when looked at carefully, not intelligible for very good reasons, perhaps to do with employing the wrong people to do it or making them work too fast or myriad other problems. But intelligibility is certainly not an aim that the media are worried about. It's just one that they don't always secure. The rub, I think, comes with a more serious view of what communication involves, in that communication is not merely a matter of being intelligible to your intended audience and perhaps others, but also of providing content that is accessible by your intended audience and perhaps others. So immediately there we begin to see where and how the epistemic and the ethical demands for standards in communication begin to bite. They don't bite because some regulator says it, though some regulator might say it or might not say it. They bite because if your aim is communication, then if you are so high-handed and haughty as to be inaccessible by your intended audiences, you may not communicate at all or not communicate effectively. So what sorts of things might then have to be done? Well, of course, lots of things help us when we are on the receiving end of others' communication to assess what is said. Let's for a moment assume that intelligibility is met. What does accessibility take? Well, it depends very much on context, and the media are, of course, brilliant at it in certain contexts and less brilliant in others. For example, I think they are very good at giving evidence and being accurate about the evidence they give for truth claims made in sports reporting. If you get the football results wrong, that tends to come home and bite you. But accuracy, although of course always a matter of lip service, even by the PCC, is less regularly achieved in other sorts of reporting. So I believe that aiming for accuracy would be one standard that we might think important, but then you've got to tie down what that might amount to. I would think the following things, and here I shall get gestural and perhaps a bit provocative, might help all of us to assess content that we read, mediated content. I'm not, by the way, this afternoon going to say anything specific about the difference between mediated and non-mediated content and within mediated content, media-mediated content versus non-media-mediated content. Those are all interesting things. But here are the sorts of things that I think might be helpful for readers, listeners and viewers. First of all, I think, and this is very much, as it were, a consumer protection sort of issue, although perhaps most of my standards would fall under the citizen rather than the consumer head, I think it would be extremely helpful to know who paid whom for what. That is to say, is this actually a bit of product placement, in which case it should fall under advertising standards authority and be so declared? Well, very often we don't know who paid whom, and of course cash flows may go in either direction. A story may be bought, but the reader doesn't know, or alternatively, a celeb or perhaps his or her lovely agent may pay to have a story carried, but the reader doesn't know. And so I think clarity about payments is a very simple and direct thing that helps us to assess it. This is starting at the humble end of journalism, but if you consider how much journalism is, in one guise or another, consumer journalism, fashion, restaurants, handbags, property, holidays, travel, etc., etc., I think it's an enormously important thing that readers, listeners, and viewers should know who paid, in whose interest is this done. No company would be allowed to obscure these sorts of relationships, though some do, they're not allowed to. Secondly, I think we have to think a bit about sources. Now, there's a great deal of, I think, sometimes slightly phony piety about protecting sources. And I have heard people who I think wouldn't know a source from a banana claiming great virtue by protecting their sources. I think that for readers, listeners and viewers, two things matter. It matters quite a lot to know whether there is any source or whether it's invented, and they have no way of knowing that. And then, very often, it helps them judge a story to know which sources, and usually they're not secret. Now, sometimes there is reason to protect them. That's where a public interest defence would, I think, have its mileage. But the idea that the general approach should be concealment of sources seems to me to be something that damages readers, listeners, and viewers' capacity to judge what is said. A third example, again, it's the humble end of things. Disclosure of interests matters quite a lot. The first time I suggested this to a journalist, she said, "Oh, we're too poor, we don't have any interests." I have to say, first of all, that may not be true in all cases. Secondly, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. We have moved into an era where in the political and corporate and professional worlds, the declaration of interest is a standard procedure. It's not foolproof. There is some provision with financial interests for disclosure on some newspapers and broadcasters, but I think this is something that bears a lot more thought. And disclosure of interests, this is not, as it were, identifying conflicts of interest, but it does allow an editor to say, you can't cover this one, you'd be conflicted, which is where conflict of interest comes in. Then there are, as it were, things that are widely liked within parts of the media, including rights of reply and duties to correct. I just stayed with quite humble stuff. I'm leaving it, in a way, till I've read Lara's work to know how this might fit in the repertoire of regulation. But the point about all of this, it's about regulating media process, not media content. And I don't see anything wrong with regulating process for two reasons. The first reason I gave is that process is a matter of action and it is possible to regulate it. You can regulate process. Whether you should or whether it's effective, those are further arguments, but it's possible. Regulating content has always been much more difficult. So let me say just a tiny bit about it. The classical, and in my view, very obsolete, lesson debates about the regulation of content have been about things like blasphemy and pornography and offence. And the typical argument has been, oh, well, you know, who can tell what's blasphemous? Your standards and mine may vary. Who can tell what's obscene? Yours and mine may vary, and so on. A lot of the people who make these arguments assume that Mill's harm principle will be helpful to them here. I'm not sure they're right. The harm principle is meant to distinguish between types of speech act with a certain content that do and that don't cause harm. I don't believe that speech acts are natural kinds. I don't think we can make systematic judgments about how harmful that they will be. I suspect, and this is after all the view that the law takes as opposed to interpretation in particular cases, certain types of speech act, for example, fraud or bullying, are the sorts of things that one can criminalize, and harm is something that cannot be judged on a generic basis. I find it pretty curious that lots of people who would say, of course I'm not a utilitarian, embrace Mill's harm principle as though it were part of the solution. I think it's probably part of the problem. But the main thought that I have behind these scattered remarks is that actually, if we're to talk about press freedom, we better start thinking about the arguments again and not just asserting it. If we're going to think about the arguments, we better distinguish arguments that bear on content from arguments that bear on action. And if we're going to think about the arguments on action, we've got to take it on a, as it were, individualized basis, what has to be forbidden. And there are no shortcuts via the harm principle when you try to do that. Thanks very much.